We are ready to go ahead to the third and last of our oral argument matters today. I see that counsel, at least for the appellant, is here, and perhaps for the state as well. So with that, counsel, just take your time getting settled at the table. While you're doing that, I'll ask the marshal to call the third case so that our record is clear in that regard.
Calling A240788, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Rashad Adel Collins.
All right, and counsel, I'm just going to make a few quick remarks. Just keep going ahead, settling in. So you have experience with the Court of Appeals, and I'm sure you're familiar with our proceedings. You'll ask us questions if you have them. I just want to make a few quick remarks so that we're all on the same page. We're all aware that this is currently this argument is being made available via Zoom. And so there are people for whom they are listening to these proceedings, and we want our record to be clear. We also maintain an audio recording of today's proceedings. And so for those purposes, we ask you to do a few things. First of all, when you approach the podium, take your time to get comfortable and get established, lower, raise the height, adjust the microphone. But make sure, before you start your argument, that you identify yourself as well as the client that you represent. And then keep an eye on the clock. We enjoy this opportunity to hear from you. We've already read and reviewed your briefs, but we want to have the opportunity to hear your answers to our questions. So with that, I'll just ask you to keep an eye on the clock. It goes quickly. Counsel for Appellant, you can begin when you're ready. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jenna Yauch Erickson. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Rashad Collins. Mr. Collins has raised six issues for this court's consideration, asking this court to reverse several of his convictions for insufficient evidence and to otherwise grant him a new trial. This morning, I would like to begin by addressing the insufficient evidence on the first-degree assault. I have two brief factual notes for this court, and then I want to directly address the expansive liability argument. First, the circumstances proved do not eliminate the reasonable hypothesis that Mr. Moore, not Mr. Collins, was the shooter. And one fact I would like to highlight for your honors is that the 9mm firearm, which was forensically identified as having fired the shots on Highway 94, was discovered in the same location as Mr. Moore at the recording studio on Pryor Avenue in St. Paul. That is just one fact among many that highlights that the circumstances proved do not eliminate the reasonable hypothesis that Mr. Moore was the shooter. Second, the government has never made any coherent argument of how Mr. Collins was an accomplice to the shooting, what he might have done inside the car to knowingly and intentionally aid in the shooting. Next, I want to directly address expansive liability. Subdivision 2 of 609.05 does not apply here. The plain language of the statute makes clear that it only applies to accomplices. It says something like a person liable under Subdivision 1, traditional aiding and abetting liability, is also liable under expansive liability. Mr. Collins is not an accomplice, or certainly this court cannot conclude that he was an accomplice because of the way this case was charged, the way it was tried, and the way it was submitted to the jury.
Well, there's no dispute about burglary. I mean, that conviction is not in front of us.
It's not.
So why wouldn't Subdivision 1 apply by virtue of the burglary offense?
Because Mr. Collins was a principal in the burglary. The government's consistent argument throughout this case is that Mr. Collins was one of the men, the young men, who entered the apartment. In fact, they think he was the one who used the keys, that he had a firearm on his person, and that he was seen leaving with property, the PlayStation. The victim says he saw Mr. Collins with the PlayStation.
Might an individual be liable as a principal for his own conduct and also liable for the conduct of his co-burglars, co-conspirators?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, certainly not under Subdivision 2. If Mr. Collins is a principal to the burglary, which is what the government's argument is, Subdivision 2 doesn't apply. It states very plainly that it only applies to accomplices.
Well, it says if It says a person is criminally under aiding and abetting. A person is criminally liable if he engages in what you've described, intentionally aiding, advising, and hiring. A person liable under subdivision one is also liable. So is it your position that an individual who is participating in a burglary and liable as a burglar directly is necessarily not also potentially or alternatively potentially liable for aiding and abetting others participating in that burglary?
If I follow Your Honor correctly, my answer would be no, a single human being cannot be both a principal in a crime and an accomplice to that same crime. I'm not sure if that's what your question was asking, but you're either a principal or an accomplice. You're not both.
Well, you can't be charged with both or convicted of both, but let's assume the state charged your client instead in the burglary offense strictly with aiding and abetting.
Mm-hmm.
Your position is he can't have been an aider and abettor if he participated in the burglary?
No, Your Honor, that's an entirely different circumstance. If the state had solely charged Mr. Collins as an accomplice, or if they charged two counts, a principal count and an accomplice count, and Mr. Collins is found guilty by a unanimous jury of aiding and abetting the burglary, then expansive liability applies. That's exactly what Subdivision 2 says.
But Subdivision 1 doesn't say a person who is convicted of a crime or charged with a crime. It says a person is criminally liable if, and it says a person is also criminally liable if. So regardless of whether he was charged in one way or the other, isn't the fact of his participation in the burglary, doesn't that also make him criminally liable for the acts of others who are engaging in the burglary?
No, Your Honor. And I would say there's no law that supports that interpretation.
Let's look at the plain language. Is there something wrong with my plain language look at the statute?
So Mr. Collins, under Subdivision 1, is either criminally liable as a principal or criminally liable as an accomplice, not both. Part of the problem with this case in particular...
But either. You said not both. Is he criminally liable for either?
So this is my next point, and it is responsive to your question. We don't know which one the jury found in this case. Because of the way this case is charged, tried, submitted to the jury just found guilt on count four, I think is the burglary. Nothing identifies whether this jury found Mr. Collins to be the principal or to be the accomplice. This is a problem of the government's own making. So this court, I don't think it's impossible to sort out what the jury found, because they're given instructions on both principal and accomplice liability, and they simply find guilt. So it is, this court cannot tease out now, post hoc, whether Mr. Collins is a principal or an accomplice to the burglary. But certainly the way the government argued this case throughout, they argued that he was a principal. He personally committed every element of burglary. In fact, they, again, have no theory of what Mr. Collins supposedly did inside this apartment while entering or even while leaving with the property that was intentional aid.
Counsel, how does your argument... Let's leave aside that we have three people here. I just want to focus on two people and your argument of how sub one relates to and sub two operate. How does your argument square with State v. Filippi, which looked like two burglars? In fact, the defendant in that case is described by the court as defendant and an accomplice, and the defendant in this case, Mr. Filippi, so presumably a principal. Maybe they're co-principals. You say you can't be both, but I don't know why principals can't assist one another. We'll leave that aside for a moment. But defendant and an accomplice burglarized, accomplice shot, defendant's guilty under expansive liability. Doesn't that undermine your argument that a principal in a burglary cannot be responsible for their, or can't be responsible under sub two because they were a principal?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Filippi actually supports our position. You have, Filippi requires a very careful reading, and here's why. The burglary statute under which Mr. Filippi and his co-defendant were charged is very different than the burglary statute today. So yesterday I pulled the 1980 Minnesota statutes and looked at the subdivision under which those two gentlemen were charged. It required all of the traditional burglary elements and an assault. That's the only possible crime under this set of facts those two persons could have been charged with. What Filippi says is the co-defendant is the one who testified, so there's evidence in the record, He possessed the gun. Phillippe didn't know he was bringing the gun. He's the one who fired the shot at the officers. That means that, I don't know if he's named, that person committed the assault element. Mr. Phillippe is a Subdivision 1 accomplice. That's why there's no problem with applying Subdivision 2 liability to Mr. Phillippe, because he's already a Subdivision 1 accomplice. And that's really the only way to understand Phillippe, is to go back to the statute in effect at the time and to understand the crime that was charged. So Mr. Phillippe is a Subdivision 1 accomplice to burglary in that context, because it also makes it different than this case, right? None of the other gentlemen testify against Mr. Collins, so there you have undisputed evidence in the record that the principal in the burglary was the co-defendant. Mr. Phillippe is the accomplice. No problem with applying Subdivision 2 liability, and that's why it's different than this case.
So your argument is that principals can never be accomplices to each other. Is there authority for that? I mean, I understand fully your reading of Sub 1. I'm just having trouble with the idea that principals be accomplices to one another, such that they're responsible under expansive liability for a reasonable crime, a reasonably foreseeable crime committed by their colleague.
Sure. So I would say in a hypothetical where you have multiple principals, so like in this case, the gentlemen who went into the apartment were all principals in this burglary. Again, the government's argument has always been they all had firearms, they all took stuff. They're all the burglars. That's not a problem for the government. The government doesn't need Subdivision 1 or Subdivision 2 to prosecute those people for that act. The idea of 60905 is you're giving the government tools to charge and seek convictions of persons who otherwise would not be criminally liable. Those folks are. That's why I don't agree that principals...
But you're arguing not criminally liable because that's not the way they were charged. I think my question and Judge Smith's question parallels it, which is, as the statute is written, it doesn't bear upon charging or convictions. It's just a general idea of criminal liability. So what is either the case or the rationale that would support the idea that an individual who is a principal cannot also be a person who is liable because of activity as a principal, cannot also be liable for activity as an aider, an advisor, a hirer, a counselor, with someone else who's helping to carry stuff out in a burglary?
Well, so this dovetails with the unanimity argument, Your Honor. Because of the due process requirement of a unanimous jury...
Well, before you get to the unanimity, just on the question I'm asking...
Sure. So the reason a person can't be both is because ultimately there is a set of facts and an elements that demonstrates that you are the principal of a crime, and the different offense of being an accomplice requires two different elements. I don't think my reasoning changes at all given the phrase criminally liable in Subdivision 1 and Subdivision 2. So they set up a hierarchy. Subdivision 1 has to exist in a case before Subdivision 2 applies. So my argument...
You're more at risk if you're an accomplice than a principal.
Yeah.
Right? So accomplices only could be to the underlying crime.
Yes.
Could be responsible for the other reasonably, and the principals cannot be. I understand that we read statutes, we don't think about policy, but is there a policy reason that would support that a principal is less at risk than an accomplice for the reasonably foreseeable crimes committed?
I think what the legislature intended in 60905 is sort of the notion in for a penny, in for a pound. If you are sort of think stereotypical accomplice, getaway driver. If you are a getaway driver and you know that the other folks are going to commit a bank robbery, they're going to do all of the elements of bank robbery, but they also harm someone during that bank robbery, it should have been reasonably foreseeable to you as the person who agreed to go be the getaway driver that that might happen.
But why does it make sense? And that's true. But so why does it make sense that there's more potential criminal culpability for a mere accomplice than the principal? That doesn't seem to make sense to me, but explain why you think that's so.
I don't know that I have to make sense of it. I think that's what the legislature wrote in the statute. Quite plainly, there is a hierarchy. Subdivision 1 has to be triggered.
It's quite plain only if your premise is correct, which is one cannot be criminally liable as both an accomplice and a principal. And That language is not in the statute. You're asking us to infer that. I think you're asking us to infer that since it's not in the statute.
Well, so again, I would direct, Your Honor, to this particular case. Mr. Collins is not criminally liable under Subdivision 1 because we don't know what theory the jury found guilt on. Because both principal and accomplice liability for each of these four counts are submitted to the jury and the jury issues one finding of guilt. So at a minimum, even if you think my premise is wrong, I don't think it's possible for this court to discern that this jury found Mr. Collins was an accomplice. Whether or not hypothetically on a set of facts he could be, we look at this verdict that was rendered here. We're checking the sufficiency of this evidence on this record submitted to this jury. We don't know what this jury found. They just found guilt. They're given the...
Was your client the only one found guilty in the burglary?
No. Damon Davenport is currently serving a sentence for the burglary.
So why wouldn't that circumstance refute your premise?
Because the jury has no idea of that. That's not a circumstance proved on this record. It's true. It's factually true, but it's not a piece of evidence.
Well, for two principals participating in the same burglary, entering at the same time, leaving at the same time, carrying out different stuff, and then getting away together, that's not... Your view is that you need something more to show that they're assisting each other?
But those two persons can both be charged as a principal.
I understand that. But my question is, does that not necessarily imply that they are also assisting each other? They're participating in the same burglary.
No, Your Honor. I would say this is a sort of fundamental criminal principle that is not what the law intends. Aiding and abetting liability is intended to cover persons who are not, cannot be prosecuted as principals. That's why it is a tool. It is an additional tool for the government when they can't get somebody on principal liability to loop them in. That's why it exists. I see, oh, no, my time is not expired. I have 11 seconds.
And of course, you'll have more time for rebuttal. And
yes,
if we
thank
need
you,
more
Your
time
Honor.
In the moment, we'll give you that as well.
I would just for the moment say that neither 60905 nor any other authority identified by respondent supports the theory that Mr. Collins, on this particular evidence and these particular verdicts, can be deemed an accomplice under Subdivision 1. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Britta Nicholson from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of the respondent, who is the state of Minnesota. I would like to begin by addressing arguments raised in appellant's reply brief and also raised already during oral argument this morning. Appellant has argued that there is no way to discern what type of liability the jury found for the burglary, whether it was principal versus accomplice. However, the transcript of the verdict and the written verdict forms both state that they found him liable for aiding and abetting count four, a burglary. So I would encourage your honors to look at the verdict forms, which I believe was index number 46, and then also to look at the plain language of the verdict when they announced it in court. They said, "We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of aiding and abetting a burglary in the first degree." So that in and of itself resolves this issue. The appellant's argument that he was convicted as a principal does not apply, and expansive liability under Subdivision 2 does apply based on what his actual conviction was. And that alone is dispositive of this issue.
What's your position However, as to whether an individual can be, under Subdivision 1, both a principal and an aider and abettor?
I believe somebody can be both. For example, in this case, and with burglaries in general, we have a group of principals who all arguably committed all the underlying elements of the burglary themselves, but they were also helping each other. The legislative intent and the concept behind accomplice liability revolves around the idea of a situation where people have a common design and a common purpose. Those are the languages used in case law. And Subdivision 2 embodies the well-established principle that the entire group who work together come up with this idea and walk up to that apartment building with the same goal, the same purpose, that they are all liable as a group for their common plan, for what happens from their common plan and their common goal of executing this burglary. And in this case, for example, We have in the record facts to demonstrate that both Davenport and appellant committed every element of the underlying burglary themselves. They entered the dwelling without consent, they were both armed with firearms, and they both took something. In the video, it shows Davenport leaving with the PlayStation and appellant leaving with some type of black box. However, they also helped each other. They came up with this idea together. And specifically, case in point, is that appellant unlocked and opened the door for Davenport to walk into that dwelling without consent. And the evidence even shows that really Davenport was kind of the mastermind behind this burglary. He was the one that had the dispute with the victim over Facebook in advance. And it could be said that this was his goal. His best friend, the appellant, was willing to help him with that. And he was basically helping Davenport carry items out of the victim's apartment.
So is there case law authority? I mean, first of all, I think your first argument is you don't need to resolve this because we know he's in a better, based on a special verdict, right?
Correct.
Secondly, even if we didn't have this, we don't need it. Is that your argument? Does it matter how a person is charged or found guilty?
No, that does not matter, Your Honor. And for that authority, I would point you to the Segura case, which is 2 Northwest 3rd, 142, Supreme Court 2024, which it basically says that we have never required for accomplice liability that somebody be charged and convicted of a specific offense. All that matters is that there's enough evidence in the record for the jury to conclude that the person was liable of a specific, criminally liable as an accomplice for a specific crime or occurrence, and then that would trigger and be enough for subdivision 2 expansive liability. So I don't think it's really even controlling what the appellant was charged and convicted of, as long as there was sufficient evidence in the record for the jury to conclude that he did aid and abet, for example, Davenport's burglary, and therefore he is liable for the reasonably foreseeable consequences of that burglary.
I know you have other issues to deal with and you think this one is clear, but if we're looking at Philippi, for example, I'm curious whether I haven't looked back at the different statutory provisions from the 1983 case. Your opposing counsel has indicated a distinction that we should draw. Were you able to see that statute and whether or not a distinction should be drawn with the current burglary statute?
Full disclosure, I did not pull up the burglary statute from the 1980s, but resting on the plain language of the Philippi opinion, I respectfully disagree with that interpretation. The language talks about co-conspiring to burglarize and co-conspirators in a burglary, and that was their focus when those two individuals entered that drugstore. Their plan was to rob the drugstore. And so that was the underlying conspiracy that the court focused on. And then there was a lot of language explaining that whenever you participate in a burglary, it being interrupted is reasonably foreseeable. Force being used is reasonably foreseeable. And that's why subdivision 2 liability applied. So, and also I do think there are additional cases beyond Philippi that support the premise or that have examples of defendants committing every element of the underlying or intended crime themselves, but then still being held liable under subdivision 2 for expansive liability for violence committed by their accomplices. And those cases are the McAllister case, Supreme Court 2015, the Merrill case, Supreme Court 1988, and the King case, Supreme Court 2023. In all of those cases, the underlying intended crime was a robbery or a burglary, and the defendant themselves committed every element, underlying element, and then they had an accomplice that committed an act of violence, and under subdivision 2, expansive liability, that person was still held liable for the violence, even though they committed every element of the intended crime, the robbery, and burglary themselves. I think those create a useful analogy for this case.
Can you speak to, now we have, let's turn more to subdivision 2. If the evidence, if we pause it for a moment, that the evidence shows, and maybe you agree that Davenport was not the shooter, that the shooter, and let's say that we think that the evidence could support either Moore or the appellant being the shooter, how does expansive liability relate to Mr. Moore? What is his role? What does his role have to be in the underlying crime? What is proved in this case about his role in the underlying crime? How does sub 1 relate to sub 2 and his relationship to the underlying crime in sub 1 versus what happens then in sub 2? Is there a relationship? Does he need to be an accomplice or a principal in sub one for there to be expansive liability under sub two for his actions?
For Moore's Mr. Moore?
Actions. In order for appellant to be responsible under expansive liability for Moore's action, what does Moore have to be in the underlying crime?
So I think he could be either a principal or an accomplice, because under either of those theories, he is criminally liable as the principal for the underlying and intended crime.
So he has to be responsible for the underlying crime, right, a co-conspirator in the underlying crime, either you're saying as a principal or an accomplice.
Correct. And
when you say he, you're referring to Collins or Davenport? Or Moore?
For Mr. Moore. And, you know, there is evidence, you could argue, that Moore was also armed when he entered the dwelling, and he entered with the intent to commit a theft, and so therefore it was he himself committed the burglary. Or even if he didn't have a firearm, it would still be a second-degree burglary. So he was part of a conspiracy to burglarize this apartment. And then if he was the one that fired the shots from the car, he was doing that in furtherance of the burglary to help them escape, help them avoid detection and identification, help them avoid the consequences of arrest, and help them fundamentally leave and successfully go away with the stolen goods.
So if we had a case, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if we had a case where it was undisputed that Moore was a shooter, undisputed, what would the state have to have proved and what did they prove here relative to Moore's participation in the underlying crime? What did it have to prove and what did it?
I think it would just have to prove that he was involved and participated in the underlying burglary, and the state did prove that in this case, that he drove up, was a passenger in that black Jeep, that he was one of the people that entered the apartment with his conspirators, and he then, by firing theoretically at the officer during the flee, he helped aid in their escape, which was part of accomplishing the finalized burglary.
As I read the statute, I don't want to take us too far afield. You only have 6 minutes left, but I'm not sure I read any requirement in subdivision one for, in this case, Moore to have even been involved in the underlying offense. It says a person is criminally liable for a crime committed by another person. So let's assume we're talking about Collins being criminally liable for aiding and abetting. And then the next statute says any person liable under subdivision one, which would be theoretically Mr. Collins, is also liable for any other crime committed in pursuance of the intended crime if, and it goes on, but it doesn't necessarily, it says liable for any other crime. It doesn't say for any other crime perpetrated by the individual who's being aided and abetted. So if you have a third person who's only a participant in, say, the getaway or something other than the original crime after the fact, it seems to me, at least the way the statute's written, is that liability might be broader.
And I can see that, Your Honor. In my review of the case law, there were cases where if somebody learns of a crime as it's being committed and then steps in and aids, that they're still liable even if they weren't part of the initial beginning of the crime or the scheming. So I do think it could be even more expansive than that when it comes to Mr. Moore's role. With my remaining time, unless Your Honors have additional questions about this topic, I would just like to clarify a few things regarding the first-degree assault instructions, which were raised in appellant's brief. Specifically, the argument that the first-degree assault instructions were confusing and inaccurate. Overall, the theme here is that appellant is treating assault fear, assault harm, and assault attempted harm as three unique crimes that require three distinct sets of elements in the jury instructions. However, as argued in the unanimity portion of my brief, fear, harm, and attempted harm are not three separate and distinct crimes. They are three means of committing one crime, an assault. Thus, there was no need for the district court to include three additional sets of elements for crimes that he wasn't charged with, when appellant was only charged with one crime, first-degree assault. The district court defined the term assault within the elements of first-degree assault, and it was consistent with the statutory definition, which is not plain error. And specifically, I also want to address the argument that the instructions failed to define attempt, and they omitted the elements of attempted assault. The most important clarification here is that appellant was not charged with attempted assault. Specifically, he was not charged with attempted first-degree assault. He was charged with the completed crime of first-degree assault, and the jury instructions included every single element of that offense. An attempt to inflict bodily harm is not a standalone substantive offense that appellant was charged with. Instead, it is one of three ways to complete an assault of someone. As a result, the district court was not required to list all the elements of attempted assault, a crime that the appellant was not charged with, in the jury instructions. The district court properly included the term the attempt to inflict bodily harm in the definition of the assault element, consistent with the statutory definition of the term assault. And if the jury needed more direction, the instructions defined the term attempt earlier in the jury instructions, which the jury was free to reference when interpreting the first-degree assault instructions. As the jury told them, you must consider these instructions in light of all of the others. Appellant relies on the Kuhnau case.
That's the attempted murder instruction. But your correct. First argument is you don't, even without that, a jury is adequately instructed on an attempt to commit bodily harm as a subpart of the assault charge. Is
correct.
That right?
Because appellant's main argument is that all of the elements of the offense weren't included in the jury instructions. But that is just simply not the case, because he was charged with completed first-degree assault, and every single element of that crime is included in the jury instructions. And that is largely how this case is distinguishable from Kuhnau, which was cited in appellant's reply brief. In Kuhnau, the concern was that there was a crime that was not defined by its elements anywhere in the instructions. But as I mentioned, in our case, first-degree assault, all of the elements are in the instructions. Appellant takes issue with not reiterating the definition of certain words and phrases within those elements, but those definitions are elsewhere in the instructions, and the jury was able to rely on those to enhance their understanding of the elements. Appellant is trying to frame this as if there was an element missing, but in really what appellant's argument is that there was a definition to explain an element that was missing. Kuhnau stands for the proposition that a failure to include all the elements of offense cannot be remedied by referencing the other elements of a different offense. But that's not what happened here. Instead, this case is controlled by Richardson, which makes it clear that a term used within the elements does not need to be repeatedly defined. As long as the term is defined somewhere in the instructions, the jury can rely on that definition every other time it's used in the instructions. So there is no issue with the elements missing in this case. That's just simply not the case. On that same theme, appellant also argues that the Assault 1 instructions omit the specific intent element of assault fear. However, appellant's brief cites the Fleck case when making this argument, but Fleck makes clear that the definition of assault fear requires the state to prove the defendant committed an act with specific intent, the intent to cause fear in another of immediate bodily harm or death. Almost verbatim from Fleck, the jury instructions say, the term assault, as used in this case, means an act done with the intent to cause another to fear immediate bodily harm or death. So there is no need. I basically failed to understand the argument about how the intent required for assault fear was not included in the jury instructions, when basically that language from Fleck, appellant citation, was basically copied and pasted verbatim on two instances, actually, on both pages 1298 and 1299 when defining the crime of first-degree assault. I see I'm out of time, so unless your honors have other questions.
Let me just check. Any questions?
I just want to read, if you don't mind, my relative to the first issue that we spent most of the time on, which is sort of how this operates, is there sufficient precedential case law? What's the best case on this? Or is this a novel thing, or is this not novel? Like the three different parties, et cetera, and how this applies?
I think it would be the cases that I mentioned earlier, the Phillippe, Merrill, McAllister, and King. Those all very clearly illustrate the proposition that somebody can commit all the elements of the underlying intended crime and then still be held liable under subdivision 2 for the violence of their accomplice.
Okay.
Thanks. Thank you. And I would just ask that this court affirm appellant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We are ready for you. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are two things the government can't avoid: its own argument in its brief and the way the jury was instructed here. Page 29, because some of what government has said here today is brand new and has been forfeited. At page 29 of the government's brief, they argue, while the evidence was clear that Deputy MK did not suffer bodily harm during the shooting, the jury still would have returned a guilty verdict for first-degree assault because the shooters attempted to inflict bodily harm on MK. That's their own theory in their brief, that this was an attempt case.
An attempt to commit bodily harm as a subpart of attempted, but not charged with attempted assault, is what I heard the other side argue.
Yeah, I frankly don't understand the argument. They say this isn't an assault harm, it isn't an attempted assault, and it isn't a fear assault. It's something different that has...
Assault, which includes attempt to inflict bodily harm.
But then the jury needs to be instructed on the fact that attempt has its own elements and what the definition of those elements are.
Why does it need to be instructed on attempted assault?
Because that
it's
is what...
It's an actual assault, which is defined in part by attempt to... which includes an element of attempt to commit bodily harm, unless I'm misunderstanding, but that's what
Sure. So this answers Your Honor's question, I believe. The other thing that they can't avoid is the way the jury was actually instructed. This is at page 34 of my brief. What the jury is told is the term assault, as used in this case, means an act done with the intent to cause immediate fear of bodily harm or death, the intentional infliction of bodily harm, or an attempt to inflict bodily harm. So regardless of what their theory is, the jury was instructed that it can be any of those. Again, our position is those are three different crimes. Even if we call them means, the jury still has to be instructed what those words mean. So if the jury, as respondent has argued, if the jury can properly find guilt on page 29, of attempted first-degree assault, attempted deadly force assault, then they have to be instructed what that word means. All the legal elements that the jury needs to find guilt have to be in the jury instructions.
Were they asked to find whether guilt on attempted assault?
They absolutely were.
Attempted assault?
Yes, because they're given that as the definition of assault, and of course the first-degree assault uses the word assault, they're told it can be any of these three things. They're then not told what assault fear means. They're not told what attempt means. Interestingly enough, they are given the attempt instruction on count one, and they acquit on that count. So this matters. This issues two and three in respondent's brief are essentially different sides of the same coin. Either it's possible to conclude that this instruction had too much in it. It had too much because fear is an improper basis for a deadly force assault. If you disagree with that, issue three says it didn't have enough because it omitted elements of these offenses that the jury was supposed to find guilt on. One way or another, the instruction was erroneous. Jigs are not the law. That's true. But it is notable here, this doesn't even come close to matching the jig. The jig gives different alternatives. Again, the jig says don't do this. Don't instruct a jury on harm and fear in a single count. But if you do, here's how to do fear, here's how to do harm, here's how to do attempt. Even when attempt isn't charged, when you're using attempt as one form of assault, the jury has to be told about substantial step. They have to be told about the specific intent requirement. This jury didn't hear any of that.
Just so we're clear on the context on appeal, this issue is purely one of a plain error.
It is, Your Honor. Yep, there was no objection to this instruction in the district court. But it is prejudicial because, again, if we take respondents' argument at face value, that the jury, they believe the jury must have found guilt, the evidence was most clear, of the attempt form of assault, even if they're calling it a means, that is one of the offenses that the jury wasn't properly instructed on. That makes it highly prejudicial to have omitted the definition of attempt, the substantial step element, the specific intent element of attempt, when they believe that's what the jury found guilt on. And again, issues two and three sort of mirror each other. Either the instruction had too much in it or not enough. It can't have been perfect because it doesn't look anything like the jig. And the jigs, at a minimum, are circumstantial evidence of the practice in district court in Minnesota every day. 90% of the time, the jig is what the instructions are. They may not be the law, but they're evidence of what common practice is. So
What does common practice bear on our analysis as to whether the instruction was proper?
You determine whether the instruction was plainly erroneous because there was no objection. It was plainly erroneous because it violates lots of cases that say you can't omit elements. Common practice doesn't necessarily come into the determination of the plainness of the error. I do think it helps contextually demonstrate why it matters. Or on the fourth prong of plain error, why people would care. Why everyday Minnesotans would care about this case. Because in 90% of cases, district courts get it right. They follow the jigs and they get it right. Here they got it abundantly wrong. I see my time has expired. I would just indicate to this court that What happened here was the district court was doing its best to squeeze all of these things into a single count. Accomplice liability, principal liability, attempted assault, fear assault, assault harm, and as respondent now argues, two different shootings by two different people in two different places. That's hard to do. The district court failed to do it correctly, and Mr. Collins should receive a new trial.
That's my same question. Is there anything novel here in these facts that would require, in your view, a precedential decision about how 60905 liability works? Or is there case law that you say, no, this is it, and tell me what that is to decide it?
Sure. I would say if this court agrees with respondent's position, and if part of that analysis is that a single human being can be both a principal and an accomplice to a single crime, I think we, the practitioners of the state of Minnesota, would very much appreciate that in a published opinion.
What if we agreed with you?
Oh, I'm sorry. Do we need to reach that decision in light of the special night of the verdict?
I'm happy to address that, Your Honor, if the court will permit.
Please, go ahead.
The verdict forms mean nothing. Here's why. I don't think the government contests that both principal liability and accomplice liability are submitted to the jury on every count. Their argument to the jury is that Mr. Collins is the principal, and the verdict forms, so respondents' brief cite Epps for this. I think that's the only citation, but that's the only one I remember at this moment. Epps is a special interrogatory case. The jury is given a verdict form that has, it's a crim sex case, it says coercion, check here, force, check here. So what Epps says is, sure, in that case we know the jury found both. That's not this case. It doesn't say principal liability, check here, accomplice liability, check here. They're instructed on both. They're told you can find guilt of either, and they just find guilt. So the verdict forms are not helpful to this court trying to sort out what the jury did and whether the jury found Mr. Collins was a principal or an accomplice. It doesn't tell us anything. All of the verdict forms have the same language on them. Certainly accomplice liability is submitted on all four counts, but so is principal liability. The verdict forms don't answer that question.
And I guess my question, is there already precedential case law that says a principal cannot be an accomplice? In other words, something that would actually codify in a syllabus point your argument?
I'm trying to think of a case. I don't know that there's a case that says that, Your Honor. Okay. I think for me, the most helpful framework for that question dovetails with the unanimity argument because to be a principal, take the shooting. To be a principal, Mr. Collins had to pull the trigger. To be an accomplice, he didn't. He definitely didn't. Mr. Moore did. But he had to do something with knowledge that Mr. Moore was doing it and intending to aid him. Those are different facts and different elements. Because they're different, have different facts and different elements, I would say both cannot be true.
But in this context, we're talking about burglary. And so when you have multiple burglars, I'm not sure the either-or dichotomy that you present in a shooting applies.
Sure, Your Honor. And I would sort of just hearken back to fundamental criminal law principles and say if they're all principles, they can all be charged, found guilty, convicted, and sentenced for the crime of burglary. It simply doesn't matter whether they happen to help each other along the way. They're all principles. Accomplice liability was developed in the law as a tool to give the government an option for the person who maybe didn't take anything.
And if it turns out they all happen to be... you're out of time. May I?
Oh, please, go ahead.
If it turns out the government believes they're all principals, but the government decides to charge them all as accomplices, you're saying the government can't do that.
One bone to pick, Your Honor. I think they can charge it that way. I think I wish they wouldn't, but certainly you have to instruct the jury properly, and we have to make sure as an appellate court that you can validly get a conviction on those grounds.
I guess that's my question. Not can they charge? Can there be a valid conviction on the grounds of accomplice liability if the government charges accomplice liability of three or four burglars without knowing that they're all... Somebody obviously committed the burglary, and they're all seen carrying stuff out. Could the government charge all of them with aiding and abetting, and are they all, put differently, are they criminally liable for aiding and abetting?
My understanding has always been, and I think the best policy is, in a group crime, This often happens with juveniles when they're all doing something together. The government cannot charge every member of a, I'll put it differently, not charge, cannot secure a conviction against each member of the group, each as an accomplice, unless they identify a principal. There always has to be the principal of a crime. There can be no crime.
There's a case that supports that? Or is that just a theory that you're operating under?
Well, I think that's sort of, again, a fundamental principle of criminal law. If there's no principle, there's no crime. One person has to commit all the elements of burglary, and then people can help.
Clearly, that's the case. Mm-hmm. But if someone's residence was burglarized, allegedly by five individuals seen on camera coming and going with material, your view is that if you can't identify anyone, if no one is named particularly as the principal, they all can't be charged with aiding and abetting. That's your theory.
I don't think, so. Because this helps me view it. Let's say you have five persons and they're all tried together, because that I think that's the easiest way to think about it. No, all five cannot be guilty as accomplices because they all can't have sort of intended to aid a principal-less crime. This is the way the government waters down its burden of proof. They say, well, I don't know. We don't know who did what. We don't know who shot out of this car, but somebody did. So that's what they would do, is charge Collins.
So we're clear. I understand that's your theory. Mm-hmm. Just so we're clear, going to Judge Smith's question about whether there's any precedential support for it, are you able to identify any case law in Minnesota that supports what you just, the conclusion you just reached?
I don't know of any case that says a principal, a person cannot be a principal and an accomplice. I also don't know of any case that says you can. I don't think the question has been presented this squarely before, which is part of the reason the case law doesn't address it, which would speak to Judge Smith's question about a precedential opinion. I think it would be helpful. Thank you so much.
We have exhausted you, counsel. I very much appreciate hearing arguments today from both sides. Very well briefed, very well argued. The matter is now submitted to this court for a decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory timeline. So that concludes our oral argument matters. We are now in recess.
Please rise.